Earthwatch, Robert Knight, you Earth have you have Knight? 15 seconds. 15 seconds. Go.
Hello?
Yeah, you have 15 seconds before we got
to
go.
I wanted to tell you, okay. I wanted to tell you about the incident that happened in West Long Branch, 4th of July.
Okay, that's a story. Don't have time. Don't have time. Got to go. Okay. Jim Foran's coming up.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Call back next week. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, it has been a beautiful night tonight, and it's going to stay that way. Jim Foran will be up in a minute and a half with Hour of the Wolf. His guest is Harlan Ellison. And I really appreciate your wisdom, and also great thanks to Dan Dorenberg for his insight on DAS and Trapwire and all of that. And you, the callers, the most brilliant audience in the world. Here at WBAI. Send me an email, Robert Knight, that's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. And stay tuned and support the station.
Well, precipitously, we ended just a little bit early there, but not so early that we can't tell you that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And as Robert said, coming up your way in just a few moments will be Hour of the Wolf. We will have a movie review and then an extended interview with the one and only Harlan Ellison. Stay tuned. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us on recording, but both recorded today, a review of David Cronenberg's new movie, the review by Genevieve Valentine, and then, for the feature event, an interview with Harlan Ellison. Stay tuned.
This is Genevieve Valentine, reviewing for WBAI. Tell me what you mean, or don't. Halfway through David Cronenberg's new film Cosmopolis, one character demands this of Robert Pattinson. She doesn't get satisfaction. Neither will you, but that doesn't mean it's not worth sitting through. Robert Pattinson plays Eric Packer, a billionaire financier who, at the movie's start, decides he needs a haircut. As his limo goes crosstown in the sort of agonizingly slow traffic that seems less surreal the more time you've spent in New York City, the film unfolds in a surrealist series of one-act plays as he runs into his wife, takes a series of meetings with coworkers outlining the freefall his finances are in, and watches the streets outside get more dangerous. There's more plot than that, but barely, and it's a thing the film's not concerned with. Though there are a few recurring characters, with the scenes largely disjointed and very much contained in the limo, Robert Pattinson's performance sinks or swims with his scene partners. In some cases, it works out marvelously. Samantha Morton, as Chief of Strategy, is amazing, and Paul Giamatti appears in the film's third act and is himself, which tells you pretty much everything you need to know. Some scenes, you're just going to have to sit through. It's not a subtle film. It begins with an epigraph about rats as units of currency, which turns out to be less a motif than it is fair warning. But at the same time, it's a film genuinely concerned with ideas, which overcomes a lot of the stagey blocking and leaves you thinking. Tell me what you mean or don't. But there's enough to think about that I, at least, will be back in the theater. This is Genevieve Valentine, reviewing for WBAI. You can also visit me online at GenevieveValentine.com.
And we're going to figure out a good capper for that, so that when she says GenevieveValentine.com, it'll either be GenevieveValentine.com or .com. One should also mention, by the way, that Genevieve's Nebula-nominated award novel, Mécanique, a tale of the Circus Trisulti, is still very much available and very, very, very much worth reading. Okay, I am still slightly in flux. It has been quite a busy and eventful day. So many things going on. And all of them good, I must say. But this is the capper. This is showtime here, live radio. Even though, well, for live radio, it's awfully recorded. But at about 3 o'clock this afternoon, I prearranged a phone call. Well, before I get into this, I must say, there is a sad notice today in the world of science fiction. Harry Harrison, lovely writer and lovely man. I met him once in the company of Harlan Ellison and Gordon R. Dixon, 25 years ago. Harry passed away earlier today. And for more information, for right now, because we don't have time, I recommend go to The Guardian, the newspaper The Guardian, and there's a very good obit of Harry Harrison there. Okay, Harlan. Harlan Ellison is iconic. He was very important to this radio show for many reasons, one of which is when he lived in New York, he would come down every so often, just come in on at least one occasion, semi-unbidden. I just should say semi, because he was told, you want to come by? Do so. And he did so. And he is a controversial figure. He's a brilliant, brilliant figure. If you don't know his name, you probably know his work. It is arguable. Last week we had Norman Spinrad on, and one of the great iconic episodes of Star Trek was his. But I think also many people would say that perhaps the best episode of Star Trek ever written, bar none, was Sitting on the Edge of Forever. That was by Harlan. Of course, as is usually the case, changes were made. Harlan was unhappy, and stories were told. Harlan has been on Hour of the Wolf through the years many times. 8 or 9 times, but this is the first time that he has been on in at least a decade. Now, we recorded, he is not in great health, so he was in bed, and we recorded this afternoon using Skype. This is something I generally don't like to do. And indeed, about 40 minutes into the interview, basically the technology crapped out. And we could hear Harlan fine, but he could not hear me. So we then switched to a different technology. So we're going to hear the first part of that interview, which I have been editing for about the last hour. I should mention, after I did that interview, I left home, popped over to KGB Fantastic Fiction, where there was reading tonight, and was a lot of fun, came here, recorded, and edited the movie review that Genevieve Valentine did for us, and then started editing Harlan's interview. And the part two of that interview, the last 15 minutes, are not yet edited. And believe me, it needs editing, or else there's going to be a very interesting visit to WBAI from the FCC. And we've already had more than one run-in, but at least one major run-in, particularly on Hour of the Wolf, with the FCC, and you'll actually hear me talk about that during the interview, because of Harlan and his brilliant short story, Shatterday. And if there's time, we will talk about that. So, you're going to hear the first part. It was done through Skype. There is a little bit of dropout. My voice is okay. His is a little fuzzy because of the connection. And there was a thunderstorm going on, which ultimately knocked us off. The last part of the interview then was done with both of us on the phone and me recording that phone call using a spiffy technology called Google Voice, which I would love if it wasn't for the fact that it sounds like I'm on the phone. And, well, as the host, I feel like I should be here in person. Anyway, we're now going to hear part one of that interview with Ellison. And on the other computer in this room, as this is being broadcast, I am going to be editing part two. So, boy, I do hope I have done this correctly. I am okay with my computer at home and all that, but here, let me just make sure. Is this? Yeah, that saved at the proper time. And I hope I didn't miss any major edits. There were a couple of times when Harlan called to wife Susan for some backup on information. I think I got all of these out of there. If I don't, my sincerest apologies. But otherwise, take it as it comes and do enjoy. Ellison is always, if nothing else, thoroughly entertaining. So part one of that interview begins now.
How's the sound?
It sounds just fine. How am I sounding to you?
Sounds just fine.
Okay, excellent. Well, at this very moment, of course, I'm recording from home, and a thunderstorm just began, and I can't think of anybody for whom that's, you know, as appropriate as you.
I like to be thought of as sparky.
Indeed. Well, you know, it's been a dog's age, more than a dog's age, since we've actually had you on Hour of the Wolf. But the first time I know was in April 1972.
That goes a long way back. I remember 1972 very dimly.
Yeah, well, so do I as well, but I remember your being there. That's, of course, when Margot Adler was still the host.
So are we on air at the moment?
We are now recording, yes.
Well, what's up? How have you been?
I've been doing okay, all things considered. The life, you've told me more than once. You said, are you still working for free for that Hakakpa radio station? The answer was yes, and that was 20 years ago. And the answer is still yes.
and you told me I was insane then, so you can only imagine how much more insane I am now.
Well, the paradigm shift of culture has changed, and most people are working for nothing now.
Yeah, but not willingly.
That's true. You have that going for you.
So to speak, indeed. Yeah, and one of these years, I'll figure out how to monetize all this. Outside of that, I do computer stuff. Health is relatively okay. I know you've suffered a setback or two in the last few years.
Yeah, I've been bedridden for a couple of years, and I speak to you now from my bed. My voice has gotten ratchety and throaty.
but the mind is obviously still there. You've had a bio movie made about you in the meantime, right?
Yeah. You have such sharp teeth.
Yeah. So what did you think of the movie?
I think quite a lot of the movie. I had a very little hand in it. The man who did it, Eric Nielsen, works with my memory is failing me.
Okay, you know what? This is a point where I wanted to edit it, and I am just going to go ahead and skip ahead a tiny bit, because Harlan and I spent the next 5 minutes trying to figure out Werner Herzog's name. So we're going to skip that, should have been edited out, and we're just going to pick up from there.
He was a kid, and he showed up for one of my lectures, and he said, you know, I take some pictures. And I said, no, I didn't mind. And he went ahead and started taking the film.
Yeah, it's weird. I'm looking at the IMDb entry, and it's so incomplete. You know, it gives his name as director and writer, and we start hearing all this, so people already know. What's your tally at this point? How many published or produced works in total have you had? I see a number of over 1,700 works.
1,700 stories, essays, articles, nonfiction, columns, but it looks like it's about 99 and counting. The total for books.
Wow.
Is 99 and counting.
Yeah. And one of the things we should give due note to the latest book, and this appearing for the first time under your own name, because we do have to thank Hicks Books for being the catalyst for this interview, have republished, or for the first time ever published, Pulling a Train.
Pulling a Train is one of two books that we made up of an old paperback of mine called Sex Gang that I didn't want anyone to know anything about for years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
Get my name off it. I was ashamed of it. But we took it and we updated it and we added new stories. And it seems to be selling like mad.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And it's funny. It's ironic over the years. I know I've got my copy somewhere of Gentleman Junkie. But that wasn't under a pseudonym, was it?
No, Gentleman Junkie was under my name. And oddly enough, Gentleman Junkie will be out in a few months.
Oh, good.
It's being redone by Subterranean Press, along with The Deadly Streets, and they're going to be done in hardcover and a matchbox set.
I know the reason behind some of the well-known pen names that you've had, like Cordwainer Bird, which is a wonderful and long story in and of itself, but I'm noticing on Wikipedia they list four pen names for you. What is the purpose of them?
Well, the only purpose was that when I was telling the stories, I was selling them to paperback pocket-sized magazines, and I could write a 3,000-word story in a night and take it down the next day and sell it, and they'd pay me. But then a backlog would build up, and when they needed stories for a magazine, they would just dip it into the drafts and see what they had in different lengths. And if they needed something, and they needed one by me, they would make up a pen name. That's all.
Yeah.
It was just a matter of they didn't want to have the same name on the masthead 5 times.
Yeah, that was something. That's a time honored tradition, going back to the pulps.
Well, yeah, there's any number of reasons for using pen names. I mean, they kept using pen names for The Shadow and Doc Savage and all of the major characters in case their regular writer didn't get a story in that time. They just slipped one in by Norval Page or someone else.
So tell us a little about Cordwainer Bird.
Well, Cordwainer Smith was a great writer, and I had great admiration for him. And when I came out here, I found that I had to have a pseudonym that I could put on scripts that were not scripts that pleased me. And when a studio would come out with a script, I would register Cordwainer Bird. The bird is flipping the or giving the bird.
Right.
Or for the birds.
Right. It's a funny combination because one is an actual honorarium and the other one not so much.
Well, I have a black sense of humor, what can I tell you?
That's putting it mildly, I would say. Anybody who's seen a boy and his dog has a pretty good idea of what your sense of humor is.
Well, there is humor in the story. It's a dead serious story, but there's always room for humor in everything.
I would agree with that. It's I find myself very often biting my tongue for the things that I would say, but you've never done that.
Well, every once in a while I'll say something that I regret, but it's always too late to call it back.
I'm not sure that I should ask for an example, but
I'll give you an example.
Okay.
I was doing a signing a number of years ago for a book of posters of science fiction and fantasy movies. Ron Borst was the editor, and they had a very big signing at the Dangerous Visions bookstore. And accompanying me were Robert Bloch and Ray Bradbury. So the four of us were sitting at a table, and you had to go down one side of the table to take care of Boris, who was at one end, and then Bradbury, and then Block, who was sitting next to me, and we were up against the wall, and then I was at the end, and the line went out the door and around the block and into the parking lot, and they had ropes set up. There must have been 1,000 people, and it was a hell of a bug, and we were doing a good job. And people, fans particularly, don't understand a lot about courtesy when you're dealing with people you don't know. And they treat you half as if you had just stepped off the top of Mount Shazam, and half as if you're some kind of dog that, you know, they get to kick around. And a woman came up to me and she said something. She was holding a book and she said something incredibly, incredibly rude. It was midway between I love you and here, sign this for my dog. And I heard a voice say, you know, when I hear someone say something like that, I know you weren't born yesterday, because nobody could get that stupid in just 24 hours. And the woman burst into tears and threw down her book, and everybody in the line just shrank back so they wouldn't get hit by the shrapnel. And it was, of course, me. And I wanted to call it back, but she deserved it, I guess. You can't be rude to total strangers and expect them to just treat you as if you're royalty.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good example. You have certainly earned, through the years, a reputation for, you know, the good Harlan and the bad Harlan and all that. I know there have been times that I have been totally freaked out by things that you've said to me, and I think it had to do with the fact that I was being very fanboy, boy oh boy, and something you didn't react well to.
Well, you know, public stature, I'm not even going to say fame, I'm just going to say public acceptance brings with it a great many attitudes, and everybody brings to it their own interpretation of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
People have an attitude about you before they ever meet you. Now, I was brought up very polite, and I was brought up to be very polite. But I have a very short bent threshold, very, very low. And when people are rude to me, I just snap back immediately. There are a number of niceties that have escaped me. Like when someone says something incredibly cruel or harmful or a bit of gossip that is intended.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And they do. They say those kinds of things. Or one guy walked up to me in England and he had a poster for Babylon 5 on which I had worked, but my name wasn't on it. And it was all signed, particularly with one of the characters who had just left the series with a big scandal and had made Joe Straczynski very unhappy. And I didn't feel like signing it. And when someone comes up to you in the signing line, they don't understand that when they buy a book, that's what they bought. They bought a book. They didn't buy a signature. They didn't buy my smile. They didn't buy my kind words. They didn't buy anything except a book. And they demand of you that you do things that you don't want to do. And this jerk kept saying, sign my poster. And I said, I'd rather not, thank you. And he said, what? And I said, no, I don't think I want to sign this poster. And he stayed there for 10 minutes screaming and yelling at me to sign it. And finally, I got the biggest, fattest marker I could find. And I signed right over the face of the woman who had made Joe Straczynski unhappy. And the guy screamed and yelled at me, wanted it. Money back, and he wanted the convention to close down. And everybody just said, piss off. I just don't give interviews anymore.
Yeah.
But apparently there is no way of getting you out of my life, Freund. You are for some sin that I committed in another lifetime.
Yeah, we'll have to figure out. There are so many sins, though, that to choose from. So I'm not sure which one I am the payback for.
No, maybe it was my sinking to Lusitania.
No, that must have been it. Yeah, either that or the General Slocum, because at least that's a New York one.
Yep, I remember it.
you were there. Are you writing as of late?
No, the last thing I wrote won the Nebula, and that was kind of my That was kind of my goodbye piece. I just don't write anymore. I haven't got the energy. I've got clinical depression, and it takes all the energy out of me. I don't have any more. I used to have huge muscles from typing. I don't have them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't write. But I figure after 100 books, and there are more coming out. There are more coming out there. Anybody who's interested, all they have to do is go to harlanbooks.com, harlanbooks.com, and they will see these new releases. I had 6 books this last year.
Jesus. Not bad for somebody who's considering themselves retired.
Yeah. It just keeps going. And it's very strange and very iconic and very ironic that all the things that I spent my years really breaking my ass over, now they're issuing things like Getting in the Wind, pulling a train and Getting in the Wind, which are the 2 books, and they're my Juvenilia. The kid gang stuff when I first started, when I was first learning to write. And everybody's praising it like crazy, saying how passionate it is and how powerful. And I thought, gee, if only I had gotten reviews for this when I was writing the stories that I think are really worthwhile.
Is there a favorite era of your writing? Point when you felt like everything was dead on?
Well, it's an extensive period. There are moments, there are high moments when I hit something, when I write something like, but there's a whole period during the 60s, 70s, and 80s when I was just knocking out one after another. There were killer stories. And I think that's when I was at my peak.
Yeah, and there are so many of them. It's every single one that came out was a moment of happiness I don't know if happiness is the right word, but it was an occasion. It was an occasion.
Well, I was writing like no one else was writing, and I was ahead of my time on so many things, as we can see from the fact that so many of the things that I wrote then are being ripped off now for movies and not being done very well at all. But I still have stuff coming out, and I still have new stuff coming out. DC Comics is going to be doing a huge graphic novel line called Seven Against Chaos, which is my version of The Magnificent Seven. And art by Paul Chadwick and art and color by Ken Stacy, and it's just it's going to be a knockout.
Oh, that sounds great. When does that due out?
That'll be out early this coming year. We're coming to the end of this year. We're in August already. It ought to be out in the before spring, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
It'll be a large book and it'll be well publicized. And then there's Phoenix Without Ashes, which just came out from IDW this last year, and was the first book of mine ever to make it to the New York Times bestseller list.
I remember that one well. And, of course, the title has such a wonderful story behind it because of that horrid TV show.
TV series, yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of people keep saying, why don't you redo the series right? And I say, yeah, get me somebody who wants to spend a couple of $1 million and we'll do it.
Well, there comes another question, because all of a sudden there seems to be a limited amount of actually good SF on TV. In the 80s, you worked with George Martin, did you not, on a Twilight Zone series?
Yes, George came on after I left the series.
That's right. That's right. You did the first season.
George came in and took over my spot.
Right. And And out of nowhere now, he's become the biggest thing on TV, or at least one of them. And while I don't watch it because I have a low tolerance for gory stuff, you know, Game of Thrones is huge, and it's good world building, it's good fantasy. And then well,
good for George, I say. George has always been
exactly.
a hard worker. He's the sweetest man in the world.
He really is.
I'm delighted that the show is doing so damn well.
And then now HBO is doing American Gods by Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
That's the next big thing. So the question is, with the advent of CGI and the idea of, oh my God, maybe real science fiction or fantasy can make money, do you think that perhaps there are better times for production ahead?
Well, there are, but the people who are still at the helm are as dumb as they were. The people who do the actual work, who put those things up on the screen, are talented and enormously intelligent. But the people who make the decisions, for the most part, are dumbcups. They are people who ought to be out better, you know, repairing shoes than making movies. And they don't have the background, and none of them have done much reading. They don't read anymore, so they are not privy to all the wonderful things that have been written: stories, books, movies, scripts, teleplays that are just waiting, that are just lying there, pulsating, waiting to be made.
They don't
have access to their own treasury.
Yeah.
By the way, the name of the director that Eric Nelson worked with is Werner Herzog.
Oh my! He actually worked with Werner Herzog on that?
No, not on Dreams of Sharp Teeth, but he's made six films with Werner Herzog.
Ah.
Werner Herzog's producer, and he's a director himself, and. Werner Herzog's films would not be what they are were it not for Eric. And Eric brought a lot of that to Dreams of Sharp Teeth, the film about me.
Yeah, the idea of Herzog directing one of your works of fiction is something I would love to see.
We are friends, and we have talked about this. And he likes me, and I like him. But he always has so many ideas of his own that before he would get around to getting to one of mine, he's got 100 of his own to figure out.
If you could choose one or two of your own works to be done properly, correctly, the way you would really like to see them done, what would it be?
Well, Joe Straczynski, J. Michael Straczynski, has done a brilliant script of Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's being circulated around town. Had it not been for another film which took the basic idea and stole it and did it very, very, very badly, and I had to sue them, and when it came to the end, they offered me my name on the picture, and the picture was so bad I wouldn't do it. Took my name off it. That's one I'd like. I also like Peter Jackson to do I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
He would have a very interesting take on that. You know, unfortunately now he's a bit booked. But
yeah,
in a dream universe, that would be great. I have to say that I am still a fan. I mean, while it's great to think of the ideal money projects and all that, I'm still a big fan of the low budget film that gets it right over the huge circus and carnivals of over budgeted work that suck. Obviously Boy and His Dog is a good example. I mean, it had zero budget and it got the film. If people didn't know you had written it, they would have known that you had written it.
Well, the first version of A Boy and His Dog was lovely, and I always liked it, except for the sexism. But we were going to do it as a television series. I had written it as a movie. There's a whole lot more to that story than has been ever put up on the screen. It's a full 70,000-word, 80-word, 80,000-word novel-length screenplay.
Is that in Brain Dreams?
It's going to be. We're going to do. We're doing Brain Movies.
Brain
we're
movies,
doing
sorry.
It as a separate book. With the script and the short stories and everything all together.
Okay.
Brain Movies is one of these publishing 180 books done with my my imprimatur, Edgeworks Abbey, and we have three more books coming out within the next 3 months, and one of them is going to be Boy and His Dog, except it's called Blood's a Rover.
Yeah, which was
the original title for
yeah, it. Yeah, I remember it well. And you wrote a sequel called Bloods Are Over, did you not?
Well, no, Bloods Are Over was going to be the full title. The first part that was published was A Boy and His Dog. Then I published a part called Egg Sucker. Then I published a part called Run Spot Run. And then the longest version, which is called Bloods Are Over, and they all mass into the one script and make a full book. Part of the book will be in script form, part of the book will be in prose form, but it'll be all four of those sections together, all under the title Bloods Are Over.
That's great. I'm looking forward to that. It's very interesting, by the way, when A Boy and His Dog first started appearing in movie ratings books like the Leonard Maltin book, it initially was rated as, quote, a bomb. By now, I think it's up to either 3 or 3.5 stars.
Yeah, it was ahead of its time, and it was a very low budget. And films like that didn't get the kind of attention that something big and horrible like, Funny Lady would get.
Oh, God. Yeah, I believe I was at the premiere showing of that movie at a Worldcon in Kansas City. Does that sound right?
Well, it could be.
Yeah. I mean, I know it was shown there, and you were introducing it and all that. I think it was the first time it had been shown to an audience.
Yeah, and the film kept breaking, and I had to keep vamping to keep people sitting.
That's right. Not that anybody was bored.
No, nobody was bored, but it was one of the most. It's at once exciting and tedious, and you keep thinking, can anything more go wrong? And then the film would break again, and the audience would scream and yell, and I'd have to come out and say, okay, well, here's what's happening, and here's what's going on, and on and on and on like that.
The
film has certainly outlasted its time and has become a cult classic, no question about it.
It really has. It was.
We saw it. they ran a showing of it here in Hollywood at the Egyptian Theater just about 2 months ago.
Oh, really?
And I went, and it was a beautiful print, and the joint was filled. Everybody loved it.
Well, that's great. I had no idea. I didn't. I hadn't heard about that.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's also, you know, West Coast versus East Coast would be very, very nice if they did something like that here. But then you wouldn't be able to be there, would you?
No, I wouldn't be there. I was at this one, and I did 2.5 hours of chit-chat with the audience, and they had a wonderful time, and they all bought my books, got them signed, and everybody went away happy.
Oh, that's a good thing. So, let's see. My problem is there's so much to talk about. There are so many things. We've been talking about media. There's a great deal of television that you've done. There's a great deal of television and movies that have been ripped off from you. A limited amount of radio, which some of which, of course, happened through Pacifica Radio. My favorite is still always going to be your reading of.
Well, it's more TV and feature films that have been ripped off. It happens virtually every week. I'll see a film, and somebody will write me and say, "Isn't this based on such and such a story of yours?" And I'll have to say, "Well, if it is, I'm going to have to go to court again." And I'm tired of going to court on these people. People think I enjoy suing, but I don't. But if you don't sue, you just let them put their hands in your pockets and steal from you.
Well, it's the same kind of thing that, you know, publishers, music publishers have to do. They say, if we don't pursue this, I don't care how well you did it, but if you don't pursue it, then it becomes public domain, and people just say, hey, it's ours to use.
Right. So that's why I, Flying Blue Monkey Squad of attorneys and mountebanks have brought down over 270 internet pirates.
I remember that now. Yes,
we just closed out another one this week. Guy up in Canada who swears he's the only one who understands copyright, and everybody else is wrong, and he's entitled to put up whatever he wants. And we got him down in 2 days. And he'll probably pop back up somewhere because he's very arrogant. But we'll take him down again.
Yeah, and so it goes. I mean, here's a whole other can of worms, and we could do 2 hours on this question alone. But what do you think of, given the way media works today, given the fact that for somebody to obtain something, all they have to do is blink to copy it, is copyright passé? And I'm not talking about intellectual property. I'm talking about copyright.
No, I tell you, copyright is one of those wonderful magic wands that protects you and protects the small guy against the big guy. Because you can sue Time Warner, and I have, and win. I've sued AOL. I've sued Xerox. I've sued 20th Century Fox 3 times, and I've won every single time. I never lose because I'm not one of those people who makes up a phony case when there's a real case, and I can see it, and I can believe it, and it's not something that I'm just cobbling up for my own amusement or to make money. Then I go after it because suing is such a pain in the ass, and it's so hard, and it takes so much time away from doing everything else that to do it, you've got to be very dead serious about it. And you've got to know what you're doing.
Okay. Well, at this point, our interview basically crapped out. We were using Skype in order to record this interview, and a thunderstorm was going on at the time, talking with Ellison, as I said earlier, how appropriate that is. So we spent about 15 minutes at that point trying to reconnect, and sadly, it just wasn't doable. He was able to be heard, but he could not hear me, although that might be the story of my life in so many ways. So we went to a different technology. We went to a different system in which we were both on the phone. And if you thought the sound quality there was a little bit strange, it's going to be even stranger now, I'm afraid to say. But there's about 15 minutes to go, and it's always worthwhile listening. But let me, to Harlan, and let me again tell you what it is you're listening to in case you don't know. First of all, you're listening to WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. This program is Hour of the Wolf on these same airwaves in one time slot or another for over 40 years at this point. And This is an interview recorded earlier today, about 10 hours ago, with Harlan Ellison, one of the most prolific and iconic writers of the latter 20th century, and not just in science fiction and fantasy, but, simply there. And we're now going to hear the final 15 minutes of that interview that was recorded today. And again, I really need to apologize for the sound quality. And as far as the editing is concerned, well, just as that other part was finishing, I was finishing editing this part. It's been a long day. So, but we did get there, and here it comes.
We're going to pick up where we left off.
Obligation one has to go to protect one's rights. You have so much stuff to protect. So where would you take it from there?
Well, it's a very strange place I'm in at the moment. Here I am, 78 years old. And most people's careers are over at 78. I never thought I would reach age 78. I always thought I would buy it dueling with Richelieu's guards on the parapets at the age of 13. But for my sins, I have lived out to an old age. And while I do everything that, everybody else does during the day, the writing is a very strange thing. Here comes getting in the wind and pulling a train, or pulling a train and getting in the wind to get them in the right order. And these are stories that I wrote so long ago that I kind of kept them hidden. I didn't let anybody reprint them ever. And now here they come, and all of a sudden I'm being treated like an icon, like a great writer. I'm in the Encyclopedia Britannica, which paralyzed me with fear when I realized it. It's just a shock, and I'm famous, and everything I do is treated as if it was a famous person. It's like, I don't know, Zsa Zsa Gabor. She's still alive, and everything she does, people pay attention to.
Not the first person I'd compare you to.
Well, I was going to compare me to Andy Griffith, but Andy Griffith was such a good guy that...
But, I mean, you were famous easily. By the 80s, you were already totally iconic.
I know.
I'm sorry?
I said, yeah, I know, it's scary. It's
scary. Yeah. It's done a lot of people, and I would say the world, a lot of good. There was the time that on WBAI, on my show, we broadcast your reading of Shatterday. And this was right after BAI had gotten involved in the Carlin case. Which technically we lost. On the other hand, people say, open things up for safe harbor. I broadcast Shatterday, with your permission, in the safe harbor, and of course, the station was once again being taken to task by the FCC, and our lawyers, when they looked you up, they were ecstatic because of, the fame that you had behind you, and they said, oh my God, this is so easily defensible.
Well, it's
and yes, the net result of that was that they ended up not prosecuting us, you may recall,
right.
Probably largely because of your stature and fame.
Well, it's very odd. Unless you're a complete idiot or Charlie Sheen or both, you don't pay any attention. I feel like somebody in the show Lost. Sitting out on the beach watching the waves rolling in and out, and then one day I turn around and I look behind me and an entire continent has grown up. And it brings you to a halt. unless you're completely overcome with hubris, which I'm not.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of your great colleagues, Isaac, never looked back, never looked around. He welcomed that fame. He courted it.
Yeah. Well, I
he somehow, one time I called him at home, I looked him up in the directory, and I heard his voice, and I said, oh good, it's you. I wasn't sure I would get it. And he said, I know, I wanted them to listen to me under the Dr. Isaac Asimov, but they won't do it. There's different attitudes toward fame.
Well, fame and memory are the world's two largest liars.
is that an original?
I think. I don't know. I just thought of it.
Oh, well, that would make it original. It's a really good one. Another quote that has to be put up somewhere for you.
Well, there is a book of my quotes out now. You know.
That's right.
Go to Amazon, yeah. And it's got, it's called The Useless Wit and Wisdom of Harlan Ellison. And it's been selling like mad. People buy it and put it in their Christmas stockings. It's a little gift to give to someone when you go out on a date and you need something fun to give them. It's a little
there you go. Everybody should have a little in their stocking, I guess.
It's a little chapbook, handheld chapbook. And,
there you go. My, now that was leading toward another question. And, let's talk about the state of writing. Ellison the Critic. What do you like? I think we have a good idea of a lot that you don't care for. What do you like?
More and more people are imitating people who didn't learn from the classics. People who didn't learn from even movies, people who didn't even learn from sitcoms, people who just learned from one vampire novel after another. The best writer in America at the moment since Donald Westlake died is a guy named Paul DeFilippo.
Yeah, okay.
And I read Paul DeFilippo regularly. And whatever else I read is very random. I just finished a book by Kirk Douglas called I Am Spartacus.
Yes, I actually have that on my reading list. I'm a new book. I'm looking forward to that.
It's quite good. It's all about the blacklist.
Yeah.
And the state of American writing, I think, is, with the exception of a very few writers, is way down. It's divided into two camps. The two camps being the New Yorker little itty-bitty story idea. The people who are writing Pope.
What, do you think there's hope for people in the future? Do you think more clarions and more classes and stuff will help bring people along?
Well, you've got to have examples. If you don't know what's good, you don't know what to try and achieve. And since everybody's reading this trash, and more of this trash, and being corrupted even more by the internet and this 176 character messages, I guess 176, 167, something like that, it's very hard to know what to write. So unless someone breaks through, so unless there's someone who is so self-taught and so smart that they break out, like, you know, a Stephen King, we're just going to continue down this self-publishing kind of road where everything that you read on the internet is what you would have read in a fanzine 35, 40 years ago. It's very hard times for writers who have a dangerous vision, to coin the phrase. And
yeah.
It's hard for anybody to make a living. mean, writing is just not one of those occupations where you become a multimillionaire unless you're a breakthrough like Stephen King, and that happens once every lifetime.
Yes. Unfortunately, I can hear that our technical issues are not as bad as they were, but the voices are breaking up on both ends in this recording.
Well, look, why don't we call it a day? Thank you, Jim, for interviewing me again. Probably, I doubt more that I'll be doing more interviews with anybody, so you may have the last one. Which is...
No, don't say that. Well, let me finish up with of your legacy. What are you happiest with? I mean, you've done everything from performance art to cinema to well, name it. You know, you've had a finger or a foothold in almost everything. What's your favorite stuff over the years?
Well, I hope if I leave a footprint in the sand, it is that you don't f*** the writer. You leave the writer alone and you let the writer do the best work he or she can. And that those who try to steal from the writers should duck for cover.
That's good advice. That's all I can say. Well,
you never know what it is going to stick for posterity. Whether it's going to be Repent Harlequins or the TikTok Man, or somebody is going to take up I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream as a rallying song for some revolution. All I know is that I have gone my own way and done my own thing, and I've led a really perfect life. I've had a wonderful time doing it.
Yeah. But you've also inspired so many people, both with the fact that your fiction is there and can be read, but also as a teacher.
The teaching part is very nice. I'm being taught in something like 600, 700 universities.
Yeah. But also directly your teaching. I'm thinking, of course, of your Clarion West.
Ah, yes, there is that, too.
So, you know, the legacy is never going to be minor, and it's in so many different places, and it'll keep going. There's no question of that, and I'm not sure that you're as done as you think you are.
I think that's hardly possible that anybody could be as dumb as I think I am.
No. I said done. D-O-N-E. D-O-N-E, not dumb. I think you have more to contribute.
I have a couple of mantras. One of them is, these days, a little less eminence and a lot more moolah. And the other one is, I go to bed every night with everybody telling me how smart and how quick and how clever I am and what a smart little fellow I am. And I pray that I wake up the next day the dumbest person on the earth. That everybody else is smarter than I am. Which certainly takes us serious.
Well, certainly the dumb people have the power, I would say.
Well, I think they're taught and trained to be lazy. They're taught and trained to be frightened. And it takes a lot of courage to be courageous. At least the way I look at it.
Well, you have been that, and you are now, and, you know, best of luck.
Listen, Jim, thank you ever so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Well, vice versa. And I hope we will do it again.
Have a good time and have a good show.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
So, you have been listening to an interview with Harlan Ellison, recorded today, or I should say Wednesday, depending on where you are. It may still be Wednesday. Not for Friday yet anywhere, but it is Wednesday in a few places. Almost exactly 11 hours ago is when that interview was conducted. And it was lightly edited, a little bit for pauses, for technical reasons, and Also because, as you heard in Harlan's voice, he's not in the best of health at this point. He's had some serious surgery and all that, and he's mostly bedridden. And for those who know Harlan well, he was oh so friendly. And he's not always that. He, you know, in the many times that he's been on WBAI, and for that matter, on KPFK, where after Mike Hodel died, Harlan more or less steered the radio show Hour 25. So for his friend, he and J. Michael Straczynski, who later created Babylon 5 on TV, were doing that show together. In all these years, nobody would call Harlan docile, and he still isn't. He never will be. But see the movie about him, Dreams with Sharp Teeth. That should tell you a great deal about the gent. And also, by the way, as mentioned, we really, really have to thank Kix Books and Miriam there for making being the catalyst on this interview, and also a fellow, I don't have my computer in front of me, so I know I'm going to mangle his name, but we met up on Facebook, and he's the one who actually put this all together. He does some work at the great and wonderful WFMU, and also at the at WNYC, and so now he has also helped us out here at WBAI, and we are quite appreciative of it. So, at this point, initially I was thinking of possibly leaving out that last 15 minutes, but and trying to sneak in one of Harlan's readings, but alas, no. It just really wouldn't, there would have been no time whatsoever. But I've had requests from listeners for playing what I consider Harlan's all-time classic reading, I'm Looking for Kadak, which we did here quite a few years ago, 1974, unless I'm mistaken. And we will get to that one of these days. But this, but it's a 42-minute reading, and just not, well, in time. So instead, if you would like to call up and speak to us on the radio about Harlan Ellison, about science fiction and fantasy in general, I'm willing to take your phone calls. Alas, Genevieve Valentine, who was here earlier with her review of the new David Cronenberg movie, is not here to reply to her to your comments. But we do hope to make that happen. It seems like she's having fun doing reviews for us. And boy, am I happy to be able to provide that forum. In the meantime, if you want to read her blogs about movies, visit GenevieveValentine.com. Also, of course, visit HarlanEllisonBooks.com. And, yeah, as I said earlier, for a person who isn't actively writing, he's got a whole lot of new books coming out, and that's quite an accomplishment. And that's going to keep on happening for a long time to come. Telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. You know, curiously, we during the interview, we had several calls coming in. I don't think anybody was mistaking that for a live conversation. But I will say, if you would like to write Harlan, the best way to do it is to send me an email. I will just forward it to him. He, part of the price of his fame is that he doesn't live out his life too much in public nowadays. Actually hasn't pretty much since he left New York. And boy, is that a long time ago. He was used to live in the village, and there was a time when it would not be unusual to mill about in New York and encounter Harlan Ellison, Robert Silverberg, Joanna Russ lived down there. It was quite heady, a thing to be going on. And, well, there's new people now. Saw a lot of them tonight at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Readings, which is always worthwhile. Oh, by the way, my reading series, the one I produce and run, will be returning on September 11th. Think nothing of the date. We usually happen to go on the first Tuesday of every month, but this time out to avoid the World Science Fiction Convention and Labor Day, we're going on the second Tuesday of the month. So that's September 11th. And then we have that will be with Carlos Hernandez and Richard Bowes. And we're going to have a special reading also on September 27th, hosted by Veronica Shanus with Deborah Grabian from L.A. and Roz Cavini from London. So you will be pretty much circumnavigating or semi-navigating the globe for that. Good morning. You are... Whoops, no. Let me try that again. Hi there. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, well, I was miserable until you first mentioned Pattinson. And that lady.
Yeah, well, why don't you turn down your radio, by the way?
I will, of course. I'm so sorry.
That's
normally don't do that. And I know you so long. It's very hard to dislike people that, you know, when you fall in love with someone, you just stay in love with them. You sometimes don't understand them, but let's get cut to the quick. Why do I know the name Harlan? And he said, everything he said sounds so wise, and we're all so crooked on this earth. Yes is really no, and no is never no. And what was that quote he said about fame and something else is the biggest lie? What was the other
one? Oh, I forgot the second part. I'm going to have to put it online. It was a great quote, though, wasn't it?
Well, not just that, but I can't explain it. I had to deal with the two storms. Did you, at the same time you were dealing with storms, I was doing the same thing, shutting windows, cleaning. Well, I don't have to tell you. It's just doing things and failing at them all. Here's what I wanted to ask you. How could people be interesting and famous, and you know of him, and he sounded like an ordinary bloke? And the people...
Oh, he is anything but an ordinary bloke.
No, by ordinary, I meant that as a huge compliment. When I say ordinary, I mean in the way Lenin said, I'm just a working class hero. You know, a real humble person. Or cranky. Which is
A, Harlan is not humble. B, he is certainly cranky.
But Monroe was cranky, and I think of him every day, because I failed him. You know who else I loved a lot, and he was so kind? Is his first name Marvin Hamlish? What was the whole name of that person?
Yeah, Marvin Hamlish.
And I found it so, just like Harlan, he cared more for others than a lot of people do, and I find him humble. Maybe I should use the word.
No, Harlan is not. That's the wrong word for Harlan.
Really? Well, because you know. Well, why don't you tell us? Because I don't want to hog up all your time.
Well, he's he is world famous. I mean, but you can go online.
Why is he poor?
I'm sorry?
He sounds like he's poor or not happy.
Poor? He lives in Beverly Hills in a mansion called Ellison Wonderland. The movie Terminator made him millions and millions of dollars. He's
Ooh.
Written Star Trek, The Outer Limits, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Alfred Hitchcock. Yes, all that. He is the Flying Nun, for God's sake.
What Flying Nun? Even that?
The TV, yes.
He's a writer. He's been writing for years. He's written movies. He's had movies stolen from him that he litigated and won. The movie The Terminator was taken off the out of movie theaters so that they could put his name on it after an extensive lawsuit based largely on an episode of The Outer Limits that he wrote called Demon with a Glass Hand. The single most famous Star Trek episode, The City on the Edge of Forever, he wrote. Believe me, this is
why I'm listening to you. Do you see what you just did? That's what I wanted to know, what you just told me.
Oh, okay.
Well, and it's up to you to dig up these gems.
I had mentioned some of them at the beginning of the show.
No, but I missed the beginning. I only did when the lady said about your lady critic. And I was watching Brian Lehrer's repeat. You know, he does that interesting program where...
Yes, he's one of my favorite people to watch.
I had to stop listening because... Once you came on with the lady, I said, oh, I have to listen to that. And, of course, you see what you do, what's so important. You know things that other people don't know. And look at how you concisely said all that. I would have never conceived that what you just said is true.
Well, you can find out a great deal about Harlan Ellison on Wikipedia. He's a long, long entry for that matter. You can find out a great deal about him in the Encyclopedia Britannica.
I love that when he said that. That's really what intrigued me.
Oh, it's,
he was humble about that. He said, what the hell was he in that for?
Yeah, well, he
you think he was sardonic?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that on the one hand, it stuns him, and on the other hand, he's well aware of his own worth, and he's not kidding about it. You know, after you've had X many TV series and things done, and you know, over 1,700 published works...
Wow.
You know, you it's not likely for a person to say, I'm not nobody.
But he did sound like he was saying that to you today. I thought that was so beautiful.
He's calming down at this point in life.
Oh. I thought he was broke, but from what you're telling me, it's the other way around.
No, he's not broke.
But he did have to fight for whatever he maintained. That's
well, he fights for his property is the way he sees it.
Don't you think that's right?
If he, yes. I think that it's also, there are some people who would say that the things that Harlan has claimed as being based on his stuff... they feel differently. Some people will point out that, for example, there are only so many plot lines in science fiction.
Yeah.
And it could very well be there. He made reference, and I'm not going to. I will name the movie In Time is the movie that he was talking about that he said was based on Repent Harlequin, said the TikTok man. Exactly how that played out, I'm not sure. Harlan said it was such a bad movie that he didn't make them put his name on it, which was a settlement that was offered. I'm not sure of those exact issues. I have seen In Time. I am certainly familiar with Repent Harlequin, which is one of the best short stories I can think of in science fiction. And there are some concepts that are similar. But then there's also a movie called Timer, which is a mild romantic comedy. And actually, I would say Harlan did that particular storyline first in the mid-60s. But that's not to say that people wouldn't have come up, perhaps, with that idea now that science fiction has become so popular and so commercial. So, you know, again, it's not necessarily about his, consistently wanting money. It is about people protecting their copyright.
Oh, well, I understood that. I was intrigued when he spoke of that.
But I think it's also safe to say that I think there's more than one opinion on that issue. I am a fierce believer in people's intellectual properties, but I do not necessarily believe, I'm not convinced, although I don't have an easy answer for how to do it, but I'm not convinced that the way you protect your intellectual property is based on a question of simply a copy. For example, if I broadcast something on this radio station, or if I stream something on the internet, I'm not making a copy. I am streaming it. It is something that is out there. It is transitory. But if I put it out on a podcast, all of a sudden, that is a copy. One breaks copyright law, the other does not. Things are not simple.
That's confusing.
It is confusing.
A little deep for me to understand. But what I like is that, first of all, I know the name, and I love the sound of his name, Harlan. It's a beautiful name. But I don't remember any of these movies because I didn't really see those. But I really loved your interview.
Okay.
Well, you see what I mean? I like listening to you because you tell me something I want to hear.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, have a great morning. Take care. Telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
So it was Harlan who did Demon with the Glass Hand.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
Outer Limits, yes.
It was
Robert Culp.
Yes, and it was the first, or no, actually it was the second show of the second show of the second season.
I wouldn't know. I never liked Outer Limits.
You never did?
Never. I liked Demon with a Glass Hand.
So
I liked Soldier, which he wrote. Soldier,
yes.
Which is another Harlan Ellison.
Oh, that was,
and there was maybe one or two other Twilight Zones that I liked. But I was an Outer Limits kind of person and not...
An Outer Limits?
I was a Twilight Zone kind of person and not Outer Limits. Very different shows.
Well, yes.
Soldier, one was a monster show, one was science fiction
Soldier
fantasy.
Soldier was the one about the soldier from the 37th century who comes back in the 20th, Quarlo. Yes, yes. Anyway.
Yeah, it was later rewritten and renamed and called Terminator.
That's Terminator? Oh, well, yes, it is.
Yeah.
By the way, you know...
Harlan sued and won.
There must be something, you know, they've got this new network now called MeTV, and they must be sort of, you know, jumping on the bandwagon of the nostalgia stuff, you know, of TV Land, Antenna TV. In September, were you ever a fan of the series, not Twilight Zone, what was the other thing that, Rod Serling did, Night Galleries. Were you ever a fan of Night Galleries?
I thought it wasn't as good. Yes, but I didn't think it was anywhere near as good as Twilight Zone.
It never took off for some reason.
And frankly, the second Twilight Zone, which Harlan created and then George Martin took over,
yes.
I thought was better than Night Gallery.
Oh, you know, I haven't seen that many of the second one. I saw a few.
The third sucked.
Oh,
the third series of Twilight Zone really stinks.
You know, if you think about it,
in my
humble
opinion,
when they talk about episodes that people will remember To Serve Man, even if they never saw The Twilight Zone. Yes, I remember To Serve Man.
Even if they never saw Twilight Zone, let us remember that's a short story by Damon Knight.
Yeah, but remember also that it's a little bit different than what Serling did with it. He changed it a bit.
Only slightly. He padded it out to make it a half hour. It's a very short story.
No, I know. I recently read it.
But anyway, spoiler, it's a cookbook.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not sure that was mentioned in the was it mentioned in the short story? I have to think.
Of course it is.
Yes.
It's the last line of the story. It's all about. Yeah.
I always remember Serling's line about how you wind up going being the lord of a minor planet to an ingredient in somebody's soup. Now let me ask you something. You are a fan of BBC America, are you not?
No.
Oh, you're not a fan of
I'm a fan of the BBC. I do not like taking the BBC, cutting things out, and adding commercials to them.
Well, okay.
Next question.
Well,
okay. And P.S., not getting a quarter of the material. If I were able to get on BBC America things like The Hollow Crown, which they broadcast a little bit before the Olympics, being a new, you know, an all-new production of Richard II, Henry IV, 1 and 2, and Henry V, with an incredible cast and a beautiful production, why isn't that on BBC America? Where the hell is that?
What do you mean? Are you saying that BBC America cuts out stuff from BBC?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Well, let's put it this way. Or actually what happens is often the BBC cuts out, makes shows shorter.
Oh.
So that BBC America can do it. But if you are in Canada and you get the BBC World Service,
yes,
you're likely to see something, anywhere from 60 seconds to however longer. What the BBC broadcasts and what BBC America broadcasts are selective. You will never see my favorite quiz show, QI, on BBC America. You'll never see Bill Bailey's Birdwatching Bonanza on BBC America.
So, wait a minute. So you tell me that they cut out things of Doctor Who on BBC America?
No. What they do is they cut down Doctor Who to begin with.
Oh.
You know, they make the episodes shorter.
Oh, I see.
So I am no fan of BBC America. What I am a fan of is the Beeb itself. And what I want from that and what I expect from that is that they should make the BBC available in America for a price. The same way, you know, I would rather subscribe to the BBC than to, say, HBO or something like that. And then you could get BBC 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I would happily pay a nice hefty fee to get that on a monthly basis instead of getting this watered down pablum version they have. And now BBC America, we'll see how this series Copper is.
I was just going to say that.
But why isn't Copper, which is being made by American producers, why isn't that being done on American television?
Well,
and why are we buying BBC output and ITV output and with public tax dollars and putting it on PBS instead of having American money go to American producers? I'm willing to pay for the BBC, and I think that PBS money ought to go to American producers instead of English producers.
I'm curious to see what Coppers is going to do, and I'll tell you
Copper,
why.
Singular.
Copper is going to do, because you may know that, to me, this is basically, they're jumping on the bandwagon of the popularity of Hell on Wheels, because basically it's the same plot, same different city, it's a cop instead of an ex-Confederate bounty hunter. But
I don't even know Hell on Wheels. And this is a Barry Levinson show, so I think it's got a different pedigree here.
Oh, really? Well,
yes. Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay.
We got about 30 seconds.
Last thing, though. You're having Deborah Grabian on 27th of September?
That's correct.
Oh, joy.
There you go.
Lovely. Thank you. Maybe Veronica is going to be the host.
And Veronica will be the host.
Who's the other reader?
Roz Kaveny, coming in from London.
Never heard of her, but she sounds...
Well, you'll find out.
All right,
I have to get
bye.
Off. Take care. With 30 seconds left, it's time to do an outro. First of all, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned to Burn Baby Burn at Clappers with Lister coming your way momentarily. Secondly, feel free to write me, Jim, J-I-M, at OurWolf.com. And... forgive me if I don't write you back immediately, but I will get around to it. Next week on this program, I'm not quite sure exactly what I will be doing. I have a phone interview set up for either next week or the week after with the great Michael Bishop. We've been going great guns. 2 weeks ago with Daniel Jose Older, then last week Norman Spinrad, tonight Harlan Ellison, next week, if not... Michael Bishop, somebody else really thrilling and exciting. So this is what we can do here at WBAI, if only we survive. Thank you for listening. Visit the website, OurWolf.com. Join the Facebook group, Hour of the Wolf. And for more on my reading series, it's the NYRSF Readings, also on Facebook. Good morning, take care, etc., etc. Thank you so much, Harlan, for what has now become a rare interview of his. And thank you for being a listener. Good morning. We go out, of course, with Steel Eye Span, Sails of Silver. Good morning.
Just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
99 Cinco is still alive, y'all. 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. This is Burn Baby Burn. On a Thursday where we burn the American imperialist flag to ashes, y'all, with no apology. 1, 2, 3, charge. HR. Sinkle is still alive right here until 5 o'clock. Free speech, radio news, Algiers, English. Esther comes in at 6 o'clock. 99 Sinkle is still alive. The flag burning show where we burn the imperialist flag to ashes for more than reasons than one, y'all. Hey, y'all. Yo, Scotty, Massachusetts. Your music on the radar right here that they refuse to play. No such thing as free speech in America. Just permitted speech. 99 Cinco. List Alive was the first to point out that the vice president that Romney picked, Orion, endorsed him. The first MF to do that, y'all. Then we threw out the political rhetorical question, where have you seen a vice president endorse a president to be? Not even elected by the masses, the proletariats, or the revolutionaries. 99 Cinco, List Alive, Burn Baby Burn. So we do it. Romney versus the Demolition Man. Romney beat the Demolition Man. Orion. Here we go. Here we go. Are you ready to get political or die? Burn, baby, burn, Boba Bacon style. Are you ready to win this in such a political way that we don't go back to this imperialist foolishness?
All the rain washed away and it gave us clarity. You can take the air we breathe since it's always been with me.
Yo, 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 yo. This is the no-God zone where we don't force you to bow down and pray to no Selassie first. We not do that. Adakagwan. Dotoy, dotoy.
Seeds of precious life.
minutes after 3 o'clock. 5 o'clock, Shadow on the Case, 99 Cinco, Robert Knight.